This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about education through the pandemic with brilliant guest Carter Weinstein. And I say brilliant for a lot of reasons. Talking to someone from Generation Z and seeing the way in which he's been through certain struggles and felt empowered to speak up and to have the language around mental health that I see from a lot of younger people that for myself and a lot of my guests, we did not grow up with. And so in that, it gives me such hope. Because whilst it can be really difficult to gauge, to find an objective measure on how much conversations are moving forward around mental health, I do see so many examples that I could list all day long about how we are making progress. Are the resources always there? Not always. Not always by any stretch. However, as a global community, are we moving to a place where we do listen and take seriously what each other are going through, irrespective of age, background, whether we think certain things somebody has been through are big enough or, you know, warrant certain care. I hate even saying it out loud because that mentality so frustrates me. But the point is, we are moving in the right direction. I know it. I see it every day. But there's something additional where you can relate to some of their perspective on the world, and they're from the next generation, and you see how when they've had struggles and they have spoken up, that that's been taken seriously and that they've got certain support, and that, you know, here they are talking to me so articulately in a way that is so broadly relatable, so lived in a way that I think for a lot of my guests and myself included, it took a lot longer to get to a point where we could be lived in around our perspectives on mental health because of growing up in a time when so much less was said, so much less was discussed and acknowledged. And that does deprive you of a lot of the language. And so whilst I'll always be an advocate for the support that's out there getting better, getting broader, getting faster, everything that can come up on the show where improvements could be made, primarily my thing will remain breaking down the stigma, empowering people to speak up in the first place. Because if there's one thing that's scarier than there not being enough support out there, it's the idea that the support somebody could have accessed and didn't because of stigma, because they didn't have the language, the tools, the confidence to maybe even know what's going on for them in any way, and that there could be help out there. And we know what can be missed and how bad things can get when people don't get the help. So a really moving conversation today, one that it was a really practical conversation. That's what I'll say. There was a lot of Carter's perspective that I found so valuable and will definitely be quoting him on. And this, alongside, of course, today's theme, education through the pandemic, has been something we've touched on during the show. Danny and I intentionally kind of held off covering this sooner because for many of us, particularly out of the two of us, her, as someone that was involved in homeschooling, we knew the pressure was on and that parents were getting through it as best as they could. And that it may be a little bit close to the bone in a way that wouldn't have been helpful, having the conversation sooner. And so it was lovely instead to reflect of how the pandemic affected education and really the things that our guest was able to learn through those transitions and the value in connecting with people in person, in having the right tools for your education, whether that's in the classroom or not. And so it feels like a really special episode to get to talk about education again, something that, of course, I'm very passionate about in terms of the campaigning I do, in terms of something that we've covered, education as a factor in mental health, many times. And this is very much a new perspective and one that feels still very timely. So with that all said, please enjoy this conversation with Carter Weinstein in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. As a listener of this podcast, you already know how much respect we have for the work of counsellors. And I could be wrong, but I think we may even talk about counselling in this episode. We often do. One option that we often recommend is BetterHelp, partly because by signing up with their secure platform, you can be matched with a professional counsellor within 48 hours, which is massive when there's so many different routes. There's obviously challenges of waiting lists with many of the options out there, not to mention the challenges that can be about which kind of counsellor is best for you, which discipline. And when you're looking for support, that can be a lot of burden to take on. And instead, by using BetterHelp and submitting details about what it is you're looking to get out of counselling, what kind of things that you might be most keen to talk about, any preferences you have of the person that you see, they can take on a lot of that hard work and match you with someone really well suited. And if by any chance it doesn't work out and you don't feel that comfortability you're entirely entitled to have with someone you're going to open up with, you can have a new counsellor swapped in free of charge at any point. To join over 2 million people who have already taken this brilliant step for their mental health, just visit betterhelp.com/mentalhealth. As one of our listeners, you get 10% off your first month. Just visit that link, betterhelp.com/mentalhealth, to redeem. So be less alone with whatever you're going through by finding your own counsellor today.
My name is Carter Weinstein, and my first experience with anxiety was at a pretty young age. I remember specifically going away to a sleepaway camp around third grade, and I remember going with a couple of friends, and you know, these were friends that I was pretty close to. And I remember at the time I hadn't really been away much other than sleeping over at friends' houses. So this was like a 2-week sleepaway camp, which might not seem long to some people. I know people here in the Northeast go to camp for like 6-7 weeks, but it certainly was pretty daunting for me, granted that I had not been away for that long. And certainly that was a time when I felt incredibly uneasy and uncertain about myself, because I was practically in this new environment that I had never been to before in deep South Texas. I live in pretty Northeast Texas, if those of you who are listening don't know where Dallas is. But yeah, so it's a completely different part of the state, you know, devoid of any connection, did not have a cell phone, no way to really contact my parents. And to make matters worse, you know, obviously we were only able to really contact them by letterhead, and they did not receive any of my letters, any of my notes until the last day of camp. So they kind of all landed on top of each other for kind of a pretty bad scenario. And that's when I kind of realized for the first time that I had any sort of anxiety or stress or any mental health issue in the first place. Because I would say at first, I really had no idea what mental health or anxiety even was.
And when you look back on that now, are you able to see that there were any elements of that beforehand, that this was like a tipping point? Or do you think it was this brought up symptoms for the first time?
That's an interesting question, because I think people experience it in two ways. One being if there was like kind of a traumatic experience that'll go ahead and tip it, or if it's something that is almost like always been there and you just kind of needed an experience to reveal it. And for me, I would say it was almost a bit of both, interestingly enough, because I think that, you know, I had always, you know, had the separation anxiety, being away from my parents, being away from my friends, being away from my home. That's always existed. But what I would say certainly elevated it was this realization that, okay, I struggled over the course of these 2 weeks. So what's to say that, you know, the next time I'm going to go away or, you know, separate from my environment, that I'm not going to experience the same thing. So I think it was kind of it was a mix of the two.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And at the time when you're having these experiences and you're not knowing what it is, not necessarily having any of the language to express what you're struggling with, to what degree were you able to kind of like cope with it or navigate that at the time?
Very little. I really had no knowledge of how to mitigate my symptoms, you know, as it related to, you know, sweating, increased heart rate, hyperventilation, even, you know, crying. These are just, I feel like, pretty normal symptoms that can manifest themselves in almost anybody. So I really had no real way of understanding how to cope with these symptoms, specifically when I was at a pretty tough time.
And so from there, were there other experiences where you found then anxiety came up for you in other environments?
Definitely. I would say that, you know, something that my parents were certainly concerned about after my experience at camp, now granted this was only really third grade, but had they done nothing about it, had I not tried to, you know, for lack of a better phrase, conquer my fear and anxiety, then I probably would have never been able to get to this point where I'm able to be okay in college, you know, thousands of miles away from my home in Dallas, Texas, here in Washington, D.C. You know, I would have never been able to get to this point. Something that I stress a lot throughout the book, and something that I think has been critical in moving mountains for my own mental health, is this idea of exposure therapy. It's this idea of, like, you've got to put yourself in these difficult situations in order to grow. I mean, I feel like we don't grow as individuals unless we put ourselves in challenging circumstances. So, like, subsequently, I went to different, you know, other, like, collegiate institutions where I did, like, summer programs. I remember I did, like, tours around the city of Boston with my friend. Just different summer programs and camps over the summer that were similar in that, you know, I was in an environment that was different than my own. I was away from my parents, and I was away from the bulk of what I have known basically the entirety of my life. So I guess it's not really a location thing, and it much more has to do with, you know, that separated environment.
Yeah. And so it sounds like that was something that you really kept them in the loop on as soon as these symptoms or experiences came up. What was the kind of reaction from your parents?
So the reaction was incredibly positive, and I think I'm incredibly lucky in that regard, because, you know, I think that there are a lot of parents, friends, etc., who are not going to react so positively, or moreover, not even really know how to react. You know, I'm my parents' first child, and so this was obviously their first time dealing with a kid who has, you know, anxiety or stress, etc. So they were incredibly supportive, and they were willing to get me the help that I need, you know, whatever that even looks like. They wanted to certainly, like, push me to become the best version of myself, pushing me to do things outside of my comfort zone. But I certainly believe that I would not be where I am today had I not been pushed outside of my comfort zone. More specifically, I don't know if I'd be in college today because of that.
And so it sounds like you were able to find a lot of ways to kind of navigate this and put yourself in experiences where there was degrees of stress, but it was managed and it was chosen, and you had a supportive enough environment that if you had needed to drop everything and say, actually, I'm coming home, it sounds like your parents would have been very understanding.
Yeah, they definitely would have been understanding. You know, I did not go to a program like that first summer camp in terms of, like, the lack of communication. I mean, like, I was able to, all these, you know, these other programs, I was able to have my phone, I was able to contact them. And that was something that was important for me. I think an important realization that I had along my journey was that, you know, whatever stressful situation or anxious situation that you're in, if you're able to pull yourself actually out of the moment and say there's other stuff going on inside the world besides how I'm feeling, you know, like, while I'm here in DC and I'm doing my work, my family is still existing and they're still doing things in Dallas, Texas, even though it's thousands of miles away, it's still a world that's existing outside of my own, you know, thoughts that are just so consumed with anxiety and stress. So if you're able to pull yourself out of the situation via communication and just seeing what's going on with other people's lives and taking the focus off of you, I think it can move mountains in your own journey.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I think even a lot of the techniques that are taught through, like, mental health first aid, for example, follow that kind of line, even in really extreme situations. Like, one for panic attacks is people recommend, like, there's various kind of things you can do with, like, finding a spot on the wall and drawing a square around it and using that as a way to breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Or people will do, like, I can't remember quite the, Danielle would know, but I can't quite remember, there's one with, like, with numbers where you find, like, I don't know, one thing you can see, two things you can hear, and you, like, count up.
Yeah, that's a good one. And, like, just, like, any sort of, like, visualization, you know, of trying to, like stimulate your senses and understanding, you know, what's going on around you versus just being so consumed with yourself is incredibly beneficial.
Yeah, and I think even in the comparisons of these examples, you see how much anxiety can pull your focus and your feeling of lack of control to such a fine point that, depending how extreme your symptoms are in that moment, it can then be progressed to pull yourself out of it by observing the things around you versus on a day where your anxiety isn't as bad, then focusing on things that are further away, like your family, and that things are happening in the world that are still going well, even on your bad days, you can sort of have more of that perspective. But it's really difficult, I think, when, and pretty incongruous, if you assume that everyone would be able to have access to all the tools depending on where they're at. And sure. I think we can put a lot of our own expectations of, I should be coping better than this. Mm-hmm. And did you find yourself feeling that when you were trying to figure out what the symptoms were and why they were coming up for you?
I think often there's a bit of a self-deprecating aspect with mental health and anxiety. There's been this picture painted for so long, and I think it's certainly been being taken down now, that if you do have issues, you know, with your mental health and there's something wrong with you, that there's this basically caricature painted that you have some sort of, like, you know, it can almost seem like a bit of a taboo subject. But I think with so many celebrities, you know, athletes, all these incredibly successful individuals coming out and talking about their own issues with mental health, I think it's much more normalized, that conversation. You know, certainly there were points when I, you know, wanted to give up, in terms of, you know, not wanting to expose myself to these challenging scenarios, when I just kind of wanted to pack it in and basically be like, you know, it'll be what it'll be when college, you know, rolls around. I'm just going to have to endure that. I don't want to have to deal with it now. But it's almost like, thank goodness I did, you know, deal with it back then, because it would have been tenfold more difficult for it all to be piled on, you know, right now, as I'm also inundated with work and adapting to a new situation. Adding anxiety to that would have only made it tenfold worse.
I like what you mentioned there about how absolutely there's so much further to go in terms of breaking down stigma and narrow ideas of what mental illness is in real terms, despite the fact that it's so common. Mm-hmm. So widespread, you'd think the understanding would be more than it is. However, you're right that there is progress being made. And so when you look back at these times, do you remember the kind of the role models and the people that were speaking out? Because I feel like when I was growing up, I didn't see a certain prevalence of that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, I'm pretty into sports. I'm pretty into to football, basketball, etc. So, you know, when I hear these, you know, athletes, you know, such as like Andrew Luck, who was a former quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts, come out and retire. He was a great quarterback, and he retired on the count of mental health, basically saying that, you know, practice and getting, you know, and enduring all like these like physical issues was taking a toll on his mental health, and therefore he thought it was best for him to step away, even though when he was kind of in the prime of his career, and that shocked so many people. But it's sparked, you know, such an important conversation. You know, something that I reference in the book a lot are like quotes by individuals that I think are incredibly motivational. I also have a list in the book, actually, of individuals who on, you know, on different accounts have talked about their experiences with mental health. So it certainly increased exponentially over time. But I think even from the standpoint of youth, I think it's important to establish that cliche saying that your mental health is just as important as your physical health from a young age, because that's where anything is going to start. That's where the societal change is going to actually happen. If we're able to, you know, instill that ideal in young kids, even before their adolescence, I think that they're going to grow up with a much better understanding and recognition of just how important mental health is.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I agree. That's a lot of the work I try and do through mental health education. And you mentioned about that particular sports person, how a lot of people were shocked when it still can be something that we rarely see. People at the highest level taking that priority of their mental health. I think with Simone Biles, similarly, there was a lot of renewed conversations like this. Do you remember at the time if you were shocked, given your level of understanding at that point?
I would say yes, because, you know, Simone Biles is a terrific example. I mean, she is one of the best, if not the best, gymnasts in the world. And so just to see her stepping away like that was incredibly shocking. And I hope at least it was eye-opening for a lot of people, just to be like, well, this is a genuine issue. Anybody, and, you know, so to assume that even, you know, the celebrities, the people that are always on display before our eyes, don't experience that is just simply untrue. It was even shocking to me, and I've had my own, you know, experiences with anxiety, and I wrote this book, etc. But that was certainly like an interesting story, but a story that is certainly more common than we think.
Yeah, No, I find that interesting. That's partly why I asked, because similarly, as much as I do this work and I get to hear the stories behind, you know, really inspirational people I get to talk to in terms of times they've really struggled, you can still find yourself slipping into this idea of somebody looks like on the outside they have it all together, and we see mm-hmm. that somehow as being opposed to struggling with mental illness. And of course,
yeah,
that's not the case, and we know firsthand it's the case, but the dominant narratives can make it quite difficult to even within your own mind undo some of these assumptions.
And yeah, absolutely.
And yet you take a moment to step back, like I think a lot of people did with Simone Biles, and you look at, okay, how many different sports she's competing in, how many years she's been in this industry, how she's defied expectations and gone through like so many different coaches, so many different challenges, the pandemic as a sports person. And you're like, oh yeah, of course this is unprecedented stress for someone that's been through a lot alongside being through a lot of great achievements.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's shocking at first glance, but I think with everything people have been through, through COVID, which I certainly would love to get into about how it's only doubled, if not, you know, just tenfold that stress and anxiety that people already have had, you know, being locked away, not able to see your friends, not able to see your family, only being able to communicate, you know, virtually and frankly via social media, which I think is an issue within itself. But it, you know, it just piles on top of one another and only makes for a more stressful and tough situation.
Yes, and indeed, we will get onto that, because I'm interested in hearing the experience you've had around the pandemic-related pressures whilst being in education and also transitioning from high school to college, all during this crazy time.
Yeah. You know, just to touch on your last point, just about the transition from high school to college. You know, I was making that transition obviously during the pandemic, so it was a bit difficult. I have a lot of close friends who go to school and in the South. So whether that be, you know, they stayed in Texas or they went, you know, Louisiana or anywhere else in the South. So it was certainly tough being away from my friends as is. You know, I kind of had developed a close network of, you know, four or five friends that I've known for, you know, almost like the entirety of my teenage years. And it was tough certainly being away from them, but, you know, the pandemic included, you know, having to wear masks. We still wear masks all the time, you know, in classes here. So there's like obviously a bit of a social disconnect in the classroom mm-hmm. that exists still, not knowing what the dorm situation was going to look like, because there's still like a lot of restrictions in the dorm. There's COVID protocols going on. And I have friends here who are like contracting COVID for one reason or another, and they've got to go isolate, you know, outside of the dorm in a nearby hotel, essentially. So the there's still a ton of unknown and a lot of, you know, adaptation that needs to happen, because it's such a peculiar situation that no one's really had to deal with before.
And am I right in thinking that you had to deal with a lot of that firsthand then at high school in terms of changes to the education system that you quite suddenly had to adapt to?
Definitely, yeah. So this really happened around the end of my junior year of high school. So that's, you know, my third year of high school, around the end of my third year. And I remember specifically, you know, being at school with my friends, and our spring break was just around the corner, going along those lines. And so I remember it was like a Thursday when we would receive notice that we would not be having school the next day because, you know, coronavirus was coming, all this stuff. And little did we know that was going to last for, you know, all of the following months, you know, however long that was, encroaching onto our senior year. I'll admit, at first it was a bit exciting, you know, being online, not having to go to classes. I mean, I guess you can like imagine any like high school student is, you know, just kind of.
I loved snow back in the day.
Right. There you go. Yeah, I mean, hanging out with your friends, you, just being at home, doing absolutely nothing. I mean, that was a bit exciting at first, but I don't think that any of us realized that it was going to be this long term of a situation.
And even on that point, do you remember what the school thought? Like, was there any kind of indication of how long they thought it would go on for? Because I think a lot of people thought short term in the very beginning.
So that's so funny. I mean, I certainly thought short term. I mean, I had, you know, my best friend was like predicting that it was like gonna end up, you know, going on for months or weeks. And I thought that was so far fetched, and just because it was just so unprecedented. You know, I mean, there was really no telling at the time, you know, what was going to come. I mean, the school, as well as so many other schools in our area, were kind of saying the same thing as, you know, we're going to play it by ear. We're going to take this next week off because we want to keep listening. And now we're going to take this next week off. So it was kind of like that. It was just week after week after week, kind of just listening to the, you know, the Center of Disease Control here in the States, seeing, well, you know, what they were saying. It's honestly, it was so unknown and exciting that we were all in this together at first, but then it became this, you know, ultimate realization that we were in this for the long haul, and the implications didn't really start hitting, I think, until we began to make that college transition.
Yeah. And I imagine part of that will be that because it was week by week that you were finding out, you're sort of placed in a limbo. And initially that can be kind of intriguing and like, oh, what's going to happen? And then as it drags on, you kind of have a delayed realization of, oh, we've had how many weeks where they've said, okay, another week. And this is clearly going to be a lot longer.
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly, it's a feeling that is so unprecedented that it's hard to describe, because, you know, hopefully no one else will have to endure this again. But I think it's an important lesson of gratitude for, you know, just cherishing every moment that we actually get to spend together. You know, gratitude for the time that we had before COVID when life seemed so much easier. So I think it's eye-opening on multiple different fronts, but what I take away from it is gratitude for my friends and family.
I love that. And even though the feelings around it might be difficult to describe, I'm sure you can describe what home working was like.
Yeah, I mean, home working, certainly school became significantly easier. It, you know, for better or for worse, like the material became easier because, you know, we got to work on things with friends and the restrictions were let up a bit. And I think that was in part due to some of the, you know, how unorganized the schools were at the beginning, because, you know, they weren't prepared for this. You know, they really didn't know what was coming.
Oh, right. So it wasn't that way of learning was easier, but the work was less.
Yeah, okay. So it's an interesting point that you make. So I certainly would say that this really hit towards the end of my high school career when things started to matter a little bit less in terms of grades and stuff like that. So it almost became like a bit of a nice situation at the beginning. But you know, now that I'm in college and, you know, I've had to endure some difficult courses such as like accounting, which is incredibly comprehensive and hard to do, you know, on Zoom, you know, it makes it, you know, that much more difficult. I mean, there's so many people, almost like 99% of people who I've talked to say that they learn better in person. And I feel like that's for good reason. You know, having that in-person connection, not just with the teacher, but with your classmates around you, makes a world of difference. Because while it might seem fun, I certainly am not, you know, fulfilling that purpose of school of, you know, taking in the same amount of information online as I actually am in person. I feel like that's pretty similar for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'd say so. And what was that like in terms of even the college application process? Because I would imagine a lot was changed then. Certainly, I know it was here in terms of applying for colleges with open days being virtual, and what a strange experience that was for people.
Yeah, it certainly was a bit different just because not only the colleges themselves had to adapt, but, you know, testing companies, you know, we've got two big tests here in the States, the ACT, the SAT, you know, that are, you know, standardized entrance tests into college. And they had to adapt, you know, they were considering going fully online. You know, they made modifications to the tests themselves, how you can, you know, send in tests, et cetera. And then the big thing that was coming from testing was this idea that schools could go test optional, where they wouldn't require these standardized tests because kids could not get access to tests. They could not get access to tutoring, et cetera. So this was, again, like the pandemic, like almost everything else that we've talked about, has been a compiling effect of things, you know, only making themselves, you know, more difficult for teens, adolescents, and anybody else going through COVID-19.
And yeah, it sounds like you took a lot of this in your stride. Is that optimism looking back on it now, that's part of your outlook, or was there like anxiety that you were going through?
It's a good point. Much of, you know, my time during the pandemic, anything I accomplished was very virtual. I spent a fair amount of time actually like writing the book. I mean, there were like several rewrites, stuff like that, and several like different like iterations that we had to go through, because I started writing the book a couple summers back and had breaks in between, etc. But, you know, anything that I accomplished was, you know, to the best of my ability with the circumstances that I was given. I did an internship over that summer when I was going into my senior year for a local entrepreneur in the Dallas area, and all of that internship was completely online when I probably would have liked for it to be in person. Oh, wow. So I could have gotten that experience much more firsthand, but a lot of it was just, you know, reviewing due diligence over the phone, you know, being sent documents to my email, stuff like that. It was certainly a bit strange. But as time has gone on and as technology has adapted, I think it's important to note that this is a bit of the way of the world in the future. You know, I'm not saying that we're going to be online all the time, but it's become, you know, increasingly more accessible and easy for, you know, individuals like us who are across the world, for instance, to just, you know, hop on a Zoom call at any point. I mean, there's several offices, several hedge funds, several, you know, businesses that have gone completely virtual that don't even have an in-person office just because A, it's cost effective, and B, you know, it's safer in terms of health. So, you know, what our world looks like in the future and what it looks like today could be very different, or it could be the exact same.
Mm-hmm. And having seen how the impact can be different for people through education in terms of like what kind of setups they have at home, what kind of supportive environments, how each of us learn in different ways, what kind of things would you see as potential challenges if we were to move to a more digitized education in terms of mental health?
Well, I think the first thing is just reiterating exactly what we had said before. It's that social disconnect. I mean, that you clearly, you're not able to interact with people in the same way over the phone as you are in person. My girlfriend right now lives across the country. She lives back in Texas. So it's, we try to make do, you know, with this long distance relationship. But I think anybody in a long distance relationship will tell you that it's certainly not the same as being in person. Like you always wish that you were in person type of thing, because, you know, you have that better interaction, you have that better connection. And it's something that the people are going to have to adjust to. And it's a hopeful, you know, people are going to need to, you know, I think that's a massive part of social media. Something that I talk about throughout the book a lot is how social media has been so difficult for adolescents and teens. But at the end of the day, it's not going anywhere. It's only, you know, becoming increasingly more popular, and more kids are getting social media at younger and younger ages. So it's much more about, you know, how do we actually deal with the social media versus, you know, trying to throw it out. And I think, you know, virtual classrooms and virtual education is the exact same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And could you share a little bit about what you found challenging personally?
Sure. I'd say it's two things. The first being anonymity. And what I mean by that is that anybody can create a profile on social media. You know, I can go create a fake profile right now on Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, whatever you have it. You can go on there, create a fake social media account, comment whatever you want, say whatever you want, post whatever you want. And virtually there are no consequences because it is not attached to your name, to your identity. So, you know, you post something that's, you know, promiscuous, something that's scandalous, whatever, and it's on an anonymous account. You know, no one's going to actually know that it's you. And so then what happens? Then the social media platform goes and bans your account. Okay, you just create a new account. It's basically like this infinite cycle. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say would be setting unrealistic standards. And I think that's a bit of a two-way street. I think that it's got to do with A, body image, and B, lifestyle. So body image meaning that, you know, and I feel like I'm guilty of this myself, you know, see like, you know, super jacked guys on Instagram, you know, whatever that looks like. And I'm in the gym, you know, wanting to look like that, you know, and I'm sure, you know, girls deal with something similar. You know, the fact that we have to aspire to be like these individuals who, frankly, we know nothing about, you know, is certainly not healthy. You know, it's not going away either. I think that's my point, is that, you know, we have to learn to deal with those scenarios rather than just try to shut them out, because at the end of the day, we're the ones that are giving these people a platform. So, you know, if you are going to continue to support them, you have to understand that you don't have to fit this character, this image that the people on social media are trying to portray. And the second thing I was saying was lifestyle. You know, we see, you know, athletes, celebrities, you know, even just influencers portraying, you know, a lavish lifestyle of lots of money and private planes and massive houses and, you know, expensive vacations, etc. And the reality is that, you know, we don't know what that person's life actually is like. Social media, one of the biggest issues with it is that it only captures moments in time. So we're usually posting the moments when we look the best, or we are the happiest, or we're doing something that's really exciting. That doesn't mean that's what, you know, the entirety of our life actually looks like. You know, I'm not going to Las Vegas every weekend and gambling and winning $1 million, even though I just posted it on my Instagram. You know, that's not my life. You don't know if the person is happy. You don't know, you know, what's going on behind the lens. And so, you know, if kids you know, even before adolescence, you know, are able to recognize that, and that's instilled from parents at a young age, then I think that's going to go a long way in the growth of social media and how we use it.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I think one of the things I worry about, having grown up at a time when, like, Facebook in particular was very new and very novel, mm-hmm. and I played a lot of Farmville on it, and it was just this sort of, like, weird internet thing that felt very separate to other forms of communication. Mm-hmm. I think for younger people now, there's such integration in today life that what you're describing can be harder to distinguish as not reality when you see certain images or certain versions of people's lifestyles, because it's so integrated into day-to-day and how you view people. Is that something that you have come across in terms of your own experience, like trying to draw the boundaries between, okay, what is real and what isn't in a time when social media is such a part of our day-to-day life that it's not seen as, I don't even quite know how to describe it. Do you know what I'm getting at?
Absolutely. This is something that my friends and I talk about all the time, because I think it's an interesting discussion. Going back to body image, you know, one of the things that my best friend and I talk about often is this idea, like, we'll look at, like, male bodybuilders, for et cetera, because we're, like, big into working out, stuff like that. Are they using some sort of, you know, metabolic steroids, you know, or are they, like, completely natural in the gym? That's just, like, something that we think about just because, you know, like, there's so many training influencers online that are trying to, like, promote, you know, whatever, like some gym package or, you know, diet supplements, something along those lines. And we don't know what's going on behind the lens of the camera. So they might be, like, promoting something that seems super cool and they've got lots of muscles and they're super jacked and this whole nine and it seems, like, super cool. But you know, is that actually what they're using? Is that actually effective? And I think that ties right back into the anonymity thing, that social media and the internet as a whole basically creates this virtual barrier to where we're only allowed to see what the people who are presenting the information want us to see. So, you know, if they're promoting these supplements, you know, they're not going to say the side effects, or they're not going to say, okay, this was the time when it didn't work. You know, they're going to promote it to you in the success stories and what they look like, et cetera. So we're only given a certain amount of information to make us want to think a certain way. It sounds a little bit manipulative, but I feel like that's just kind of the inherent structure of the internet and how it's made for us to view.
Yeah, it's so tricky, and it's good that you're actively looking out for that, because I think in many ways you can be so aware of that disadvantage of the information you don't see. But how do you overcome that? And I'm reminded of a previous guest, Juno Dawson, who's an incredible author who happens to be a trans woman. And she talked about in a lot of her writing how, when previously living as male, she would work out a lot as a way to try and fit into a box and a gender presentation that never felt right for her. And one of the things that really kind of shattered a lot of the illusions around the kind of gym lifestyle that can exist was getting to a certain point with her personal trainer and being like, okay, I'm not having the results that I'm seeing around me. What am I doing wrong? You know, I'm doing everything you're asking. Why aren't I kind of bulking up to the same extent? And then there was a quiet word had from the personal trainer of, oh, you'll need to take extra stuff and I can get you it, but we need to, like, be careful that people don't know. And then from there, like, all of it, the illusion started to fall down, where she could then see the signs of steroids and other things that people are taking in terms of people's behavior. But there's an ability to do that when you're in the gym, that when you're online and you're seeing a perfect picture, you're not going to see certain ticks that people might have, or them having mysterious pill bottles. They're taken out of the lens.
Right. Yeah. 100% agree. A lot of it is just, like I said, hidden behind the lens of a camera. So it's all about, you know, trying to interpret what's really going on. I think that's going to be, like, the first step into, you know, using social media properly in a way that's beneficial.
Yeah. And I'm also glad you picked up on the anonymity piece, because often that can be, how can I phrase it? It's like the conversation can be very focused in a way that, like, the social media giants are big and dangerous, and we can forget that there are people using it. And it is also the behavior of all of us as individuals that can be problematic. You know, it's easier to, like, blame Zuckerberg, but I don't think he's the whole problem, and neither is Facebook. Yeah. There's so many people that feed into the influence and power of these companies, part of that does come from behaviors that are made possible. If you want to say horrible things online, those facilities are there. I would like to see them clamped down on, but then also there are still people that want to say horrible things and will find ways. So what can we do in terms of societal change and how we treat each other as well?
Yeah, it's a bit of a massive question and a difficult one to pose. I have some friends that
work. Yeah, go on. Yeah. We want the perfect answer from you right now.
There you go. Exactly right. I have some friends that work at Facebook, and something that they're challenged with a lot is making that determination, just given that they've been caught up in so many scandals as it relates to everything that we've said, but also like privacy issues. You know, there's just like some ethical things that they've also struggled with. So as a company, it's also finding, you know, because it's people that work at the company too. You know, it's not just like a bunch of drones who are just trying to take our cash, even though it seems like that sometimes. You know, it's people that also have to, you know, to find the balance between creating that idealistic, you know, lifestyle and viewpoint that looks, you know, so appealing that we need to aspire to, where people can hide behind walls and they can share, you know, selective information, but also giving people a platform to do so, because you know this is a free world to some extent, and people can kind of post whatever they want, you know. So how do you not obstruct that freedom while also, you know, maintaining, you know, a relationship with, you know, these influencers that's actually healthy and beneficial to, you know, their viewers and the people that are watching them?
And actually, quick side question on that, with your friends at work at Facebook, how do they tend to find if, you know, people respond to them working there? Do they generally get an okay reaction given their reputation?
Definitely not. So the people who I know that work at Facebook, it's basically my friend's mom and his brother. They both, interestingly enough, work at Facebook, and basically it's a bit of a touchy situation. It's like the best way I'd put it. Like my roommate's dad also works at Facebook. I feel like there's like some weird Facebook thing going on here, but it seems like
they're listening to us right now.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, they recently, Facebook in particular, has seen like a massive stock drop, you know, just due to like so many different factors. And they've been, you know, in the news with Zuckerberg testifying before members of Congress, et cetera. And so there's so many factors that they're constantly plagued by each day. And a lot of them have to do with privacy and the inherency of social media and what they've been doing. It's almost like inescapable from their perspective, because, you know, a lot of these companies have been profiting off of, you know, selling information and utilizing like platforms like this for such a long time. And Facebook is obviously a massive scapegoat for that, because they are one of the largest, you know, Fortune 500 companies in the world. And so therefore they're looked to as an example, you know, as they have, you know, so many users and so many different individuals are actually worried about this. So just to directly answer your question, I think it is like a little bit of, they're almost like a little bit ashamed sometimes, just because, you know, they're constantly getting, you know, pointed at as, okay, are you actually responsible for everything that's going on right now? And obviously as individuals, like you said with Zuckerberg, they're not. It's a bit of a collective, but still, you know, to be a part of something like that is a little bit daunting and a little bit upsetting to so many people.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing. We inherently want somebody to blame, and it would be nice if it was one set person.
Sure.
That would be more manageable than the sprawling thing that's so integrated into our life.
Yeah, I agree.
And so looking back on that contrast of how far you've come in terms of managing anxiety, what kind of things have helped you towards the place you're in now and dealing with the being away from loved ones at this point?
I would say that there are a couple of things that have worked for me and that I mentioned throughout the book. Deep breathing. You know, so many people talk about deep breathing and how it's worked for them. Listen to, you know, actors like Will Smith talks about it all the time. Wim Hof is basically like this meditational expert who talks about deep breathing and that importance. That's something that I did before my ACT, before my college standardized test. Super helpful. Visualization, just like we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast, of being able to understand, you know, what's going on in your situation and how you can pull yourself out of the situation. You know, find that happy place for you, or, you know, whether it's doing the senses exercise, just like we talked about, you know, what's physically going on around you versus, you know, what's consuming your emotions and what's consuming your head. And then the last thing would be, I think any physician, any psychiatrist, any psychologist, almost anybody would tell you this: get enough sleep and try to get, you know, try to get exercise. You know, often when we are, you know, are deprived of sleep or we are deprived of physical activity, you know, we can be irritable. I am, myself included, you know, anybody who knows me well would, you know, would tell you that. But, you know, I would say that, you know, with all these tips and with all these tricks, you know, one of these things is going to work for one person. It's not going to work for another person. You know, what I hope that people take away from this book is that, you know, this, it's a bit of a difficult journey. And, you know, and I decided to embark on this journey because, you know, I had goals of success for myself, you know, things that I wanted to accomplish, you know, from my life. It's about understanding that you're not alone, that managing anxiety is a marathon and not a sprint. But at the end of the day, the hard work is actually worth the success.
For sure. And when you look back on the situations that you've most struggled with in terms of your anxiety and the ways in which you cope today, how does that make you feel?
Relieving. You know, relieving, because it's certainly, and the journey is not over. You know, I think what's an important thing to note is that there's no like magic pill that's going to make your anxiety or stress go away. There just isn't. You know, I think that's kind of like with anything. It was certainly a bit of a difficult journey, and I'm just so glad that I've been able to have the support of my friends and family along the way, and you know, all the hard work and all the struggle that I've had to endure was certainly worth getting to the point where I am today.
I love that. Well, we will wrap up there. And if people want to find your book, where should they go?
Yeah, they can go to carterweinsteinbook.com. It's CarterWeinsteinBook.com. Or just go to Amazon. It's available on Kindle and also physical hard copy that can be sent to you.
Lovely and efficient. So organized. The website's great. Go check it out. Thank you, Carter. It's been great chatting.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.